So as of yesterday, you'll be aware I announced the latest step in the government's comprehensive plan to tackle housing affordability, a $1 billion housing infrastructure fund. This fund will help ensure more houses are built faster in the areas where they're needed most. We want to build. We want more built so first home buyers can get a foot on the property ladder, so people who work hard can reward themselves with a place they are proud to call home, and so tenants have options for good rental properties. And we want more built so our most vulnerable have a safe, warm, dry place to call home to help them get them back on their feet and help themselves. The government has the right plan to meet the challenge. We created over 200 special housing areas so far to speed up the development of land for an estimated 70,000 new homes. We're reforming the Resource Management Act and freeing up surplus Crown land for development. And over the next 2 years, another 2,000 Housing New Zealand homes are expected to be built. We introduced new tax measures targeting speculators and giving the Reserve Bank more tools to manage wider issues associated with the housing market. We're also investing more in social housing and supporting first-time buyers. All of this work is delivering results, and we're now in the middle of the biggest building boom New Zealand has ever seen. There are around 40,000 more people working in the building sector than 2 years ago, and currently 42,000 apprentices being trained across the country. We're on track to build 85,000 new houses across New Zealand in this term of Parliament alone. The fund announced yesterday builds on the comprehensive plan by providing targeted interim funding for core infrastructure in high growth areas to help ensure more houses are built faster. We are considering a range of options for implementing this. We are very conscious that some councils are approaching their debt ceilings. Therefore, any framework will take into account that. We are looking in particular at the Crown Fibre model, which will effectively see the government finance and own the assets with arrangements for the council to purchase them once the houses are sold. I've also announced yesterday our intention to establish urban development authorities for specific areas of high housing need. We'll consider the best approach for establishing these over coming weeks with a view to introducing legislation later this year. As you will have seen, I'm heading overseas later this week for a series of trade and economic meetings in Europe, the UK and Indonesia. Italy and France are important trading partners to New Zealand and highly influential members of the European Union. I'm looking forward to meeting with my counterparts and discussing how we can further strengthen those relationships in light of Britain's decision to leave the European Union. While in France, I'll also attend Bastille Day commemorations, which this year coincide with the 100-year anniversary of the Battle of Somme. It's an honour to have been invited to take part in these commemorations, and I look forward to joining our Defence Force personnel to pay respects to our soldiers who fought and died in France. Before visiting Rome and Paris, I had an informal meeting with UK Prime Minister David Cameron in London. Meetings in Brussels may also take place if the necessary arrangements can be made. New Zealand has strong relationships with both the EU and the UK. It's important we reinforce both those relationships now that Britain's referendum decision has been made. Following on from Europe, I'm leading a senior business delegation to Indonesia. Indonesia is an important regional partner for New Zealand and a key player in the Asia Pacific region. It is New Zealand's 13th largest two-way trade partner, and we see huge potential to build that relationship further. In Parliament this week, we have the first readings of the Maritime Crimes Amendment Bill and the Fire Emergency New Zealand Bill. We'll also progress the estimates debate. In terms of my own activities, as per normal, I'm in Wellington tomorrow and Wednesday. I'm in Hawke's Bay on Thursday and Auckland on Friday.
Can you agree with Arthur Grimes that you need to flood the housing market in Auckland to such an extent that it crashes up by 40%?
No, I think it's crazy.
Why?
Well, I mean, don't ask the average Aucklander who's got a mortgage with a bank where they want to see 40% of their equity disappear on a sort of notion from an economist that you're going to crash the market. I mean, what Auckland needs is, and what the rest of New Zealand needs where it's in high growth, is a sustainable supply of housing to meet the demand. Obviously, making sure the prices don't go up too rapidly is an important part of what we're trying to achieve here. But actually destroying people's equity is not what this government's all about.
Wouldn't that just take prices back to where they were at the middle of 2012?
Oh, yeah, but it also leave an enormous number of people who have just entered into the market with huge losses. I suspect it would put enormous pressure on developers. That could put pressure on some of the banks. I can't see why that's a really good idea. And anyway, practically, he's talking about the creation of 150,000 homes in Auckland. Well, last time I looked, we built about 9,000. Well, so that sort of number in the last 12 months, we're obviously on our way to try to get to higher numbers, near 13,000, but you know, where you get 150,000 homes from overnight, I don't know.
The head of the city mission in Auckland is calling for an inquiry into the housing crisis and homelessness. Would you support that? He's saying he wants political parties, NGOs, everyone involved to work together on that.
We have a lot of respect for the new commissioner, and we're quite able to work alongside him. In fact, I know our people are talking to the head of the city mission. I mean, whether that's the right response or whether it's better for us to keep discussing with what we are doing and what more support we can provide, I think that's useful. I'm not sure whether sitting around with other political parties would achieve a lot, but we are happy to engage and exchange views on the issue.
Labor and the Greens are asking for a select committee inquiry into housing homelessness for the National MP vote for that.
I'd firstly have to take that to our caucus and have that discussion. As I said, I think what I'd rather do actually is continue to engage with the city mission and other interested parties both in Auckland and again in places like Tauranga, and make sure that the government's addressing the needs that are there. We recognise there's greater need and we need to continue to work on that. I'm just not entirely sure what a select committee inquiry would do.
Would you be willing? I mean, they're saying they'll put politics aside. It's not about politics, it's much bigger than that. You need to sit down. Surely that's something happening.
Well, I think what the parties are saying, at least not the other political parties, but I think what the city mission is saying, is that there is increased demand and they want support and action for that demand. And the government is absolutely working on addressing that issue and through a number of different fronts. We're always open to those discussions.
Prime Minister, this infrastructure fund, is that now an indication from the government that you're happy for it to go out rather than up?
It's an indication that the government wants to remove any final impediments that might be there in seeing more housing built. What the construct of that housing is, whether it's high rises or whether it's moving out to more greenfield sites, that's a matter for both the council and developers and others to determine. But what we don't want is the lack of council resources to fund that infrastructure to stop those houses being created.
Are you suggesting the ground bar holders approach would apply to all of the council borrowers or just those which are close to their debt limits?
What we try and do is keep quite an open mind on how the fund might be structured, and I think it's possible it could be structured in different ways. What we know with Crown Fibre Holdings though is it's not an interest-free loan. I know that's one of the ways that things have been reported, but through Crown Fibre Holdings we own the assets, and those assets transfer to the parties that want to buy them over time. And so if you think about, take Auckland for example, because an industry loan might go and sit on their books, which is what the very thing we're trying to avoid, a Crown Fibre Holdings type structure would avoid that going on their books until they're at a point where they've got the capital through development contributions or others made for that.
Do you think that a $1 billion fund is enough, given the council says it needs $19 billion to provide the infrastructure for what's in their future urban land?
Well, council's determining that it needs around $19 billion in Auckland over the next decade for all of its infrastructure, much of which is not housing necessarily related. It's its share of the CRL functions and other arterial routes for commerce and better connectivity around the city. So that's a very large number over a long period of time. What I think is true is that the Auckland Council recognises it does have more housing infrastructure it wants to create, but does recognise it's running into its debt ceiling. So I think it does welcome the creation of the fund. Is it enough? Well, I mean, if you think about what is possible with the fund, obviously we put aside $1 billion. We think that will be taken up, and we think that as the councils get the development contributions and other resources in, they'll choose to take those assets off the ground. That doesn't mean capital couldn't be recycled, so there's plenty of options with this thing. It's just a model for speeding up the delivery of that infrastructure.
Could you increase the amount of borrowing?
Well, in theory you could, or you could, as they repaid, you could continue to recycle and refill the fund.
Just
just in terms of who can use it, can it be used for brownfields developments to upgrade roads and that sort of thing, or does it have to be green?
The test is whether you're building more houses, so it's not for existing infrastructure per se, but if you had very old infrastructure in a brownfield site and that infrastructure had to be replaced and was going to create a lot more houses, then technically it might work.
And just in terms of the how you came to the five cities, I mean, Christchurch and Hamilton have come back and said thanks potentially for the money. Did anyone talk to Hamilton and Christchurch about whether they wanted it?
Yes, so all five cities were spoken to, you know, that we were doing that. The test is whether they have double-digit growth anticipated over the next period of time. The reason Christchurch fits in there is because it had double-digit growth, and of course, you know, our responses to them actually solve that issue. So we agree with Christchurch. We think it's less likely that they will want to take up significant parts of that because the government's put in such a massive amount of resource into Christchurch. But the test is whether they fit that criteria of high growth, because by definition, another part of New Zealand might fit into the criteria of high growth, and over time we might want to add them to being applicants for the fund.
So Len Brown has signalled that he might be interested in accessing that fund for that major pipe that's being put underground from Mangere to the tunnel, Waterview tunnel, yeah. Would that fit the criteria as you see it, and if so, what would he need to prove in terms of extra housing in order to qualify?
Well, as I laid out in my speech yesterday, the test is, you know, more houses and, you know, all of those other conditions I set out, but the basic test, if you think about it, is it creates more new housing, and so I can't tell you whether that fits within there, so I want to go away and have a look at it.
So it could be possible that if there's more infill housing being developed as a result of it, or
yep.
more intensive housing inside Auckland, that it could fit?
Potentially, yeah, but it needs to fit the test of creating more houses.
Will you use the compulsory acquisition power in urban development authorities to force land bankers to develop, or is that something that's something separate?
Look, I think if you take a step back and look at the successful UDAs around the world, what's made them successful is they have total control over the particular area that they're developing, which is extremely broad-ranging control. And so as we know, for instance, in some of those areas you can get all sorts of things where a piece of land might be, for instance, covered under the Reserves Act, and it requires a change of parliament to the law in parliament to change the determination. So, you know, I don't think we're looking to go and march over the top of people's property rights. I mean, we still believe the fastest way to ensure that there is development is to make sure that there's enough supply that means that the capital gain from holding land doesn't outstrip the value that might be created by developing land. And that's our primary, you know, concern and primary focus. When you look at where people are, you know, claims at least are made that people are land banking in the special housing areas, more often than not, there are other complications that are there, or the sheer cost of development in some cases could be extraordinarily high and not fully understood at the time. So for the most part, those special housing areas are being developed and the earthworks and others are being completed. There have been one or two cases where that hasn't been that possible. I think I'm pretty sure under the special housing legislation you could actually change the designation if you want to, so it's not a matter of involuntarily acquiring the land, but in theory you could change the designation. But look, in the sort of practical world we live in, we're not trying to march over the top of people's property rights. What we are trying to do is give the development capability the biggest boost we can and take away impediments.
Did you talk to Malcolm Fraser? Malcolm Turnbull, yes.
Malcolm Fraser, no. Malcolm Turnbull, yes. A couple of times yesterday.
And?
Oh, look, I just had a discussion with him. I mean, yeah, you know, as you would, I mean, I know him pretty well. But look, in the end, what I know is what you see in the public domain, you know, that there's 1.5 million votes to be counted, there's a number of seats in play, and they won't have a better idea of that until at least Tuesday, and maybe a little later in the week.
Did you give him some advice on how to perhaps run a minority government?
Well, I offered him support if he wanted that in terms of how we have structured things in New Zealand, because I think one thing about MMP is the system is designed to full minority government, and as we know, in Jubilee and Newton, New Zealand never had a majority government on us on election night, a few seconds. And but it's Germany's had it once. And so, you know, we've become very used to how you might construct confidence and supply and all the rest of that sort of stuff. So my basic message was, you know, we've very effectively worked minority governments. You know, the previous government was a 9-year government under a minority government, so it's quite possible, and then you just got to get on and do it. It was more, more encouragement, but I mean, we'd offer that advice if people wanted.
Did he give you any sense, or did you have any discussion about whether or not there'd been some sort of voter backlash in Australia about, you know, anti the major parties, the sort of the independence, the rise of Pauline Hanson? Did he give you any sense?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, every place is a different point, and, you know, there are different conditions that apply. I mean, Pauline Hanson has sort of been there or thereabouts for a while. I know she came and went, but, you know, as I've been saying for some time now, every country has a party that sort of wants to advocate for those kinds of issues. You've got it in the UK, obviously, with Nigel Farage for a long period of time. You've got it in Australia with, you know, Pauline Hanson. You've certainly got it in France, and you've got it in New Zealand with Winston Peters.
So if it was so indecisive next year, our election, would you be prepared to work with this?
Well, we effectively neutralised that debate in 2014, so we could be clear with voters. And I can't imagine us changing that position for 2017. In other words, our preferred position is to talk to our existing partners first off. If they were returned to Parliament, we're in a position to put together a government, but we're going to sit down if Winston Peters is in Parliament and wants to have a discussion, then we'll do that as well.
Just back on housing, why doesn't the government provide some certainty of demand to property developers and house builders, you know, like Fletcher's and others, so they know that in 5-10 years' time there's always going to be a solid demand and they don't have to worry about boom bust? Why doesn't the government get in there and say, we're going to, you know, orders up, you know, thousands of houses?
Well, I don't think it's quite as simple as that. I mean, if you think about the private sector and say, for instance, take Fletcher's, for instance, in development and Three Kings, what you'd be really saying under that model is that the government would underwrite, you know, a certain percentage of all of those houses, but those houses might be structured quite differently, for instance, to what Housing New Zealand want to purchase going forward, or what Housing New Zealand want to rent as, you know, for properties that they would use in their portfolio. So I think there's a high degree of confidence from developers that they can see forward demand coming. I don't think that's what's holding things back. If you look at all of the challenges that have been there in the housing market, yes, of course, there was lack of demand in the early years when we were in government because of global financial crisis. But in recent times, I don't think it's been the lack of confidence from developers to develop. I think it's been the pace of their capacity both to get the resources, but most of all the planning and the release of land, and that's been the frustration.
Treasury today, it's economic indicators for Brexit and the impact.
Yeah.
It did note that if there was a recession in the UK, you could see that put more pressure on migration inflows into New Zealand, less Kiwis going to the UK, perhaps more coming back. Given that and Australia's position, are you worried that you might get some more pressure on the migration numbers?
I think the biggest driver of whether people go to Australia or not is less the Australian government and, you know, to a certain degree, and even their policies, although of course they have some impact, but the biggest issue is in those really big industries that have attracted New Zealanders in the past, whether they have a resurgence because of the change in prices. So if the mining sector kicks off again in Australia, you'll certainly see New Zealanders continue to migrate across the Tasman. So it's more driven by that than solely, you know, the election outcome. Of course, you know, good government helps drive economic growth and drives those opportunities. I mean, I look at the margins, it may have an impact, but I don't think it's dramatic. But I think New Zealanders have been staying home or returning because our economy has been performing well. And as long as we continue to do that, I think we will see New Zealanders stay home. But these are just sort of small factors in the overall scheme of things.
Crown Irrigation investment has been accused of wasting money on administration costs. Do you worry about that?
Well, obviously we don't want to waste money on administration, but this, because it was a new entity, and because these are very long-term projects and they require a lot of work, there was a lot of money that was spent up front on the administration side of things. But over time, this is $120 million of government resources that can be used through the irrigation scheme. So over time we'll see a lot more of the money being spent on the grants, which is what we wanted, and actually on establishing those schemes, as opposed to administration.
So you'd be concerned if this trend continued?
I don't think it will continue, because a lot of the money was spent initially establishing it, and also the work they were doing around the irrigation schemes.
Just back on Pauline Hanson, a long-term policy which is questionable.
Yep.
Does this have a reasonably favourable policy in terms of offering pathways to citizenship for New Zealanders? She may have a sort of kingmaker type role potentially. Do you think there's a glimmer of hope for New Zealanders in terms of Pauline's policy on citizenship?
Well, look, any Australian politician that wants to advocate for better rights for New Zealanders in Australia is to be welcome. In regard to that policy, I think, you know, realistically, what has been happening in Australia is we've had some movement under Malcolm Turnbull, but the big issue here is fiscal costs for Australia. And given they're running, you know, some substantial deficits, I don't think he's going to see a dramatic change. I thought we got quite a bit of movement earlier in this year. You know, maybe over time you can get more, but I don't think it's just an advocacy issue. It's ultimately because the Australian Treasury want to bear those costs. And that's been the stumbling block so far.
If Pauline Hanson made some headway on that, would you sort of welcome her with open arms and consider her a bit of an ally?
I'm not quite sure I'd describe it in the terms you used. Okay, see you later.